live, perhaps figuratively, perhaps spiritually, perhaps metaphysically. You'll have to decide for yourself. It's The Mike Novak Show, a more or less weekly journey through pristine and sometimes polluted pastures in a quest for the answer to the question, I don't have time for that right now, so let's all sing.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
And thanks for being with me, regardless of how you're hearing this. The Green Divas Global Digital Network at GDGDRadio.com or iTunes or Spreaker or Stitcher or SoundCloud or the GLN Radio Network. And of course, at MikeNowak.net, MikeNowak.net. There's more at The Mike Novak Show on Facebook. And on Twitter, you can find me with the handle at Mike Now, N-O-W. Drop me a line anytime you like, mike@mikenowak.net. I start today's show with one of my favorite horticultural authors, Amy Stewart. She is the author of many best-selling books, including Wicked Plants, Wicked Bugs, The Drunken Botanist, and more. She is also one of the co-founders of the popular Garden Rant blog. If you want really interesting takes on gardening, go to Garden Rant. You should really do that. I believe it's gardenrant.com. So she's just written her first novel called Girl Waits with Gun, a mystery based on a true story. It's not about gardening or horticulture, but it sounded like fun. And since this is my show, I can do whatever I want, in the words of Cartman from South Park. And my wonderful partner, Kathleen Thompson, who you've heard on this show before, loves mysteries. She was very interested in reading the book, so I assigned it to her. And when Amy came to Chicago to speak at Anderson's Bookshop in Naperville, I dragged her out there with me to interview Amy. I'm holding the MP3 recorder, but it's Kathleen who's actually doing the interview. If you love mysteries, you're going to like this conversation. And according to Kathleen, you're especially going to like the book. By the way, you can find out all about Amy's work at amystewart.com. Then I head out to the Chicago suburb of Glenview to North Shore Country Club to talk to a buddy of mine, General Superintendent Dan Donnelly. Now, I've known Dan for a number of years, and I always love talking to him about how he's trying to make golf courses more environmentally responsible. He talks to me about how vermicompost, or vermicompost, however you pronounce it, biochar, and native plantings in the out-of-play areas are making a difference to golf courses in the 21st century. If you're a golfer, like me, the out-of-play area is where you hit your ball out of bounds and the sign says, sensitive area, do not enter, which means that's where you lose your golf balls, but I digress. Now, if you think a golf course can't make a difference environmentally, you should also consider that he has red-tailed hawks and owls that thrive on the grounds. He also has dozens of apple and pear trees on site, which he doesn't spray. In fact, I walked away from our interview with a couple of bags of those apples that are going to be turned into applesauce, apple butter, and a few pies. I called Dan the mad scientist for the wonderful experiments he conducts with turf, which you probably know is lawn or grass. He shows me his turf plots, and even though this is not a visual medium, I think you'll get a better understanding of what a concerned golf course groundskeeper can do to mitigate the effects of chemical use and make a community and the planet a better place. As always, if you're interested in something you hear on the show, you can always get more information at MikeNowak.net. I spelled it before, I'll spell it again, MikeNowak. Let's get to today's show, which begins right after this.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
They appear to be perambulating vegetables.
We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf.
Mr. Data, be more specific.
Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Of course. Attack of the Killer Asparagus is required reading at Starfleet Academy.
Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Gwynock of Ningladore.
Captain, shields are failing. Thank you, Mr. Worf. Mr. Data, options.
Captain, it seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
Aroundtheblockpress.com. What do they have to say?
It appears that Mike Novak is a slapstick every gardener, taking all our self-delusions, mishaps, and confusions and playing them for big laughs.
That's not very helpful, Mr. Data.
No, it is, however, highly accurate.
Amy, what you wanna do? I think I could stay with you for a while, maybe longer if I do.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. Thank you for being with me. I've gone out to the suburbs again, the suburbs of Chicago, west of Chicago, to a place called Naperville. And there was a lot of traffic in Naperville today, and there was a thunderstorm. And you know why there was a thunderstorm is because Amy Stewart had come to town. And that's what happens. The skies open up, and there's lightning and noise and thunder. And Amy Stewart has been on my show a number of times, and that's because she writes wonderful horticultural books. The very first book I read of yours was Flower Confidential, mm-hmm. although I know you wrote one before that, which I have on my shelf and I haven't read it. I've actually read three or four of your books, including Flower Confidential, Wicked Plants, Wicked Bugs. What else have you
done?
Drunken Botanist. Oh, right. The Drunken Botanist, right. And they're great books, and they are just as entertaining as they sound. So I urge people go to amystewart.com where you can find all of that stuff. So it's very easy. Then I got this notice that you were writing a new book, and it's called Girl Waits with Gun. And the notice said it's not about horticulture, it's a novel. And I kind of put it on the back burner, to be honest with you, because it doesn't necessarily, I'm being really honest.
We're friends. We can say this between friends. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
I thought, okay, I could do a segment on my show. It's not really about horticulture or the environment, but it does sound interesting. And then of course, my partner, Kathleen, who works on the show, has written many books herself, said, do you know about Girl Waits with Gun? Are you going to get a copy? I said, I guess I am now. All right, let's do it. And then after that, another friend of ours wrote, a friend we've known for decades, who said, do you know anything about Girl Waits with Gun? The word's out there,
yeah,
Amy.
Yeah. Good.
And so what I did is I turned the book over to my senior mystery correspondent, Kathleen Thompson,
nice.
Who reads much faster than I do, because uh-huh. this was a few days' notice.
Yeah.
And actually reads fiction.
Yes.
She loves fiction and she loves mysteries. So this was a perfect combination. So I'm kind of a bystander here. I'm holding the recording device.
Very good.
And I'm going to turn it over to Kathleen, who is going to talk to you about Girl Waits with Gun.
Well, I've got to tell you, I loved the book and I was very relieved that I loved the book, because once I said I was going to read it, Michael just got in touch with you and said, we're going to do it. So it would have been kind of embarrassing if I hadn't, but I did. And I must say, I do like funny mysteries, and I like historical mysteries. So you had a couple of legs up to begin with, but yours in particular is funny without being ridiculous or silly. And I think partly because you grounded it in this story that is a true story, the way you have grounded all your wonderfully funny horticulture books, in fact. Mm-hmm. So is that something you particularly like to do, is grab onto some history, horticulture, reality, and then play with it?
Well, you know, in this case, I didn't go looking for, I didn't set out to say, well, let me find a true story and see if I can make a novel out of that. I mean, the Cop Sisters kind of came into my life. I stumbled across this story by accident while I was looking for something else. And, you know, it was just one newspaper clipping. But I thought, oh, this is sort of interesting. So I looked for more and a little more and a little more. And pretty soon I was starting to have a file of stuff about these three sisters. And I think I just got lucky that the research is something that I naturally like to do. So I very happily spent, you know, probably a year digging into this story. I have hundreds of newspaper articles, and I found them in the census, and I tracked down family members, and I got courthouse documents. You know, I just dug and dug and dug until I had reassembled really their whole life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then you, but then you took those, the story, and you really created the characters, didn't you? I mean, these wonderful, eccentric, funny people, yeah. You created their personalities, didn't you?
Well, you know, I got kind of lucky because with Constance, she's the oldest, and she's 35 when the story begins. I have her in her own words talking to reporters, and I even have a letter that she wrote. I don't have the letter, but a family member scanned it and sent it to me. So I know a little bit about how she sounded and what she thought about things from her own words. And the youngest, Florette, who's only 16 in this story, because she was much younger than they were, and it just so happens that she had children later in life, so I have met her son.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He is 80 years old, or a little over 80, and living in New Jersey. But he, of course, knew Florette very well because that's his mother. And Aunt Norma, the middle sister, Norma lived with them when he was a little boy and Norma was an old man. So even though the story takes place 100 years ago, the ages line up in such a way that I was just barely able to connect with one person, and maybe the only person in the world who's still alive, who personally knew two of them. So their personalities actually are more or less as described. I mean, I have quite a bit of information about what these three women were like.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because they're just charming, delightful and interesting people, and very funny. And so I assumed, well, you know, Amy's responsible for that, you know, because she's the funny one. I got to tell you, I got halfway through the book before I looked at the jacket blurbs. And then I went, Lisa Lutz? Elizabeth Gilbert? You know, you got some, not just some heavy hitters, but some people that that I really like. You know, smart, interesting, funny. Lisa, you can't get any funnier than Lisa Lutz.
Yeah.
In fact, but I like the fact that you're in this wonderful movement kind of thing that's going on now that's taking some historical backgrounds and looking at women in those situations. So, you know, like Reese Bowen and Jacqueline Winspear and so forth. Although yours is on the lighter side of that instead of as dark as Ann Perry or some of those people.
Right. I mean, because this is a true story, you know, the Cop Sisters did for quite a while. I mean, there's a lot more to come, you know, as you've probably figured out, this is the first of what is to be several more books.
Oh, I hoped.
And all based on a true story. But what the one thing they did not do is they did not go around solving murders. So it's not like these are going to be whodunits in the classical sense where there's a dead body by page 10 and by page 300, we need to know who did it. That's not what they did. They were involved in the criminal world and they were involved in the criminal justice system in some very interesting ways. But it's never really, the question with these books is never really going to be who did it. The question has a lot more to do with them as women trying to make their way in the world in 1914, and also with the, you know, the institutions or the situations that they find themselves in. I mean, since we're talking about crime writers, you know, one thing I love about P.D. James is that with every novel, she goes into, you know, first she'll be in the courts, and then she'll be at a nuclear power plant. And in every case, you get the inner workings of this weird institution that you didn't know anything about. And that's kind of her thing. And with the Cop Sisters, you know, in this book, this is set against the backdrop of the Patterson silk strikes of 1913, right. as you know, having read it. And I just thought, I got super interested in the Patterson silk strikes of 1913, but I thought, I bet I'm like the only person in the world who really wants to geek out on all of the history behind this. But people are loving it. It's so great when I'm on tour right now and I get up in front of audiences and they've all got questions about the strikes and about who organized those strikes and the labor leaders and the union issues at the time. And so I love the fact that I can put the Kopp sisters into this odd little moment in history that people don't know anything about and kind of dig into it a little bit. And in a way, that's going to be more the point of these books than solving a crime or catching a killer, even though some of those things are kind of sort of going to happen, but it's really about just being in a completely different world.
Let me just interject. That is author Amy Stewart. Again, if you want more information about her, go to her website, amystewart.com. She's being interviewed here on the Mike Novak Show by author Kathleen Thompson. And if you want more information about Kathleen, you can go to onehistory.org.
Or KathleenThompsonWriter.com. I think mystery readers or crime readers, whatever you want, love to learn about these different worlds in these different places. I think fiction readers love it. I mean, Arnold Bennett made an entire career out of showing people hotel laundries and things, you know? I think people love that, and you do a wonderful job in this book of creating that world.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, the other thing that's interesting for me is because I live in California, you know, I have to get on a plane to go out to Patterson and Hackensack and see any of this. So maybe that helps. Like, maybe it helps to be able to see it through fresh eyes a little bit, but It's an amazing thing for me to fly out to the East Coast and then to just get to go be in their world for a couple of weeks at a time.
So have you started the next one yet?
Oh yeah. The next one's just about done.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. I've got a few more weeks of work when I get home, but it's officially on the list for next September. So it's pretty much in the can and it's going
to
happen.
I'm so glad to hear that. I hate it when I read a book that I really love and then I have to wait 4 years before the sequel comes around. So I'm very happy to hear you've got the next one in the works.
So you're just cranking them out here, one after another.
Well, you know, we'll see if I can keep this up. The thing is, I had a little bit of a head start because I started working on this a year before Drunken Botanist came out. So I've been on it for a long time, and I, you know, I had a first draft of the second book just about done before I even sold the manuscript for this one. So I've had a head start that I no longer have. So for book three, it's a real open question of whether I can keep this one a year pace up or not. I mean, it's got to be a good book, you know. So it's
It's going to have the sheriff in it too, right?
Oh yeah,
he sticks around, Sheriff.
Robert Heath. Yeah, he was the sheriff of Bergen County in the early 1910s and a really good guy. Someone else who I've grown very attached to. I never could track down his family because, you know, daughters get married and change their names and things like that. But I've been saying on book tour that I really hope with all the publicity with the book that maybe some family members will come out of the woodwork. And sure enough, just a few nights ago, I got an email from someone who met Sheriff Heath once and is close friends with his grandsons and has connected me with his great-grandson. So, yeah, I'm just
that
now.
That is just great.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the scene where he gets serious with Fleurette. The dialogue you have there.
Yeah.
It really just is delightful. I mean, it's so perfect for what needed to be done right then and the right person to do it. I stopped reading when... That's good.
Oh, well, thank you. Nobody's mentioned that scene. Thank you. I appreciate that. I like that scene a lot, too.
He really, I mean, he's a good character. Uh-huh. He's a good, strong character. And I like his relationship with the girls. And his values are very nice. But when he, you know, when he takes Fleurette in charge the way nobody else can and does it with a kind firmness, not bullying or anything like that. I thought it was great.
Can I ask a short question here?
I don't know. I don't know if we're going to let you interject.
I'm sorry. I'm holding the recording device.
You are.
Do you worry when you're writing a novel like this that's set in a certain time frame with real people, mm-hmm. that you're putting your sticky little fingerprints all over it and perhaps creating a world that didn't exist, that you're commenting on the world from the 21st century perspective.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the challenge. And the last thing I want to do is write bad historical fiction that, I don't know, I don't even quite know how to explain it. Like I don't want to mess up their story, and I don't want to mess up their world. And having been in touch with the family members, I was very nervous about how they were going to feel about all of that. I mean, can you imagine getting a call from a complete stranger saying, "I'm going to write a book about your great aunt or your great grandmother," and there's nothing you can do about it, right? Like, anyone's free to write what they want. But I really wanted to treat them with a lot of respect, and to have it be as historically accurate as possible. You know, this book is written in the first person in Constance's voice, and I really wanted it to sound like her spoken voice, as if she's telling the story out loud. So I read the book over and over again out loud to try to get that voice. And I even really thought about how women of that era talked, you know, like what their speech patterns were and what their rhythms were. And I was constantly checking words. Google Books is great for this now, you know. I mean, it helps so much that I can actually go look and see how frequently
the
a word
engram.
Was. The engram viewer.
You love it?
Yes, right. You can see a bar, a line chart that shows you.
Yeah, I've used it.
It's fantastic. So I tried very hard to make it, and I read a lot of novels from that period, which help, and newspaper articles, which helps as well. But it's tricky. It's very tricky.
Well, now that I've asked you the question, let me ask that question of somebody who read the book. How did she do?
Well, I think she did very well. For what part of it is that whether she got, you know, if you could go back in time and you could see and talk with Constance and Fleurette and the others, they might not sound like the characters in the book, but no one who cared about them would find anything wrong with the way. I mean, they're good people, they're interesting people, they're kind, and they're wonderfully funny. And so who could possibly object? You know, that wasn't like my grandmother. She wasn't that smart. I don't think so. You know. But I do think that the historical background is fascinating, and I'm delighted to hear you talk about it. I just want to make sure that people understand that this is a light read as well as a serious one. You know, that there is this historical foundation to it. But I don't laugh out loud at books very often, and I did at least twice.
Oh.
When I was reading this.
Oh, good.
So,
you probably want to know where, don't you?
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I don't
That's
like...
That's dangerous, of course.
I don't like to be in the room when someone else is reading anything I've written, because I want to know what every little reaction was about. But I had so much fun getting to know them. Like, the research and the process of discovery was so much fun. And that I wanted readers to feel how I felt. Like, I wanted other people to have that emotion. So I wanted it to be one of those kind of fun books that you're like, I'm so glad I brought this on the plane. You know, I had a 6-hour flight and I'm glad this is what I had with me. Like, I wanted it to be that kind of thing that you could just inhale.
And it really is. That's fun is exactly the right word for it, because it is all kinds of, it doesn't, it's not a fluff. You know, it's not a bonbon mystery, as I call some of the ones that are out, that I do read sometimes. A time and a place for bonbons. But this isn't a bonbon. And yet it's a lot of fun.
Thank you, Amy Stewart, from the bowels of Anderson's Bookshop in Naperville, Illinois. Congratulations. And now I have to sit down and read this. So.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming out and doing this. It's always such a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakenings Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. So if your sustainable business is anywhere in Lake or Cook County, we want you to be part of our magazine. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakenings than any other magazine to help lead happier, healthier, and greener lives. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Natural Awakenings is distributed in more than 1,000 Chicagoland locations, and our readers are looking for products and services just like yours. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. If you live in the Midwest in the fall, these are the days you live for because there's not a cloud in the sky. Temperatures probably mid-60s right now, something like that. Jacket weather, as I call it. I love that. So what did I do? I grabbed my recorder and I go to the golf course. Hey, we're 30 yards from the green. I think the MP3 is a good club right now. No, I go to North Shore Country Club to talk to my buddy, Dan Dinelli. And are you the general superintendent?
I'm certified golf course superintendent.
Certified golf course superintendent. I always, you know, every time I see you, I ask you what the title is because I never remember. I know you're superintendent here, and I know you do magic here at North Shore Country Club, just north of Chicago. Let's start with the general, and then we will move to the specific, Dan. Because if you're an environmentalist, you think golf course and you think chemicals. And you think, oh boy, there's a lot. And this takes me back to a conversation I had in an airport about 20 years ago, when I was just becoming aware of environmental issues. I ran into this guy. We're both sitting there. Turns out he was a superintendent also. And I started asking him questions. I said, you know, what about golf courses? Do we really need to worry about that? And the guy looked at me and like in confidence and said, you know, if you knew the stuff we put in there, you would be horrified. And it scared the bejesus out of me. But we really have come a long way since then, haven't we, Dan?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what he was referring to, but you could argue back in the golden years, you know, before EPA and actually before we knew much about what we were doing as far as the chemicals go and their effects, side effects and whatnot. The products that we use today, I feel very comfortable with. That being said, they still need to be used with a high degree of respect. And if nothing else, resistance is a big deal, you know, with all these compounds, whether it's for human health with the superbugs that they refer to it, bacteria and the antibiotics. It's no different for us in the ag industry in the sense that if you overuse these products, resistance becomes an increasing issue. So it's important to really study and understand your whole toolbox, so to speak, and pick the tools wisely, using chemicals as the last resource, if at all possible. And that kind of leads us into what we're trying to do here now, which is explore the microbiome of the plant and the system, they call it, which is basically the microbes that are in, on, and around the plant. And just like they've learned a lot about human health lately, the last 12 or 15 years studying the human biome, and a lot of these probiotics that came from that, and you know, we're still got a lot left to explore, but the bottom line is that's a very powerful world within this community of where the plants live, just like the community that lives in our gut when it comes time for digestion and nutrient absorption and even, you know, moods and everything else that's tied into the microflora and fauna in us, just like there is with turf out in the field in the soil that it's growing in.
You say turf, and that's what superintendents say for most homeowners. It's lawn or grass. But your world, your life, is turf and how to keep it healthy. And I guess the question I would ask is, can the biome, as you described it, that is the micro and macro biology of the soil, because turf has to grow in soil. Can it coexist with synthetic chemicals, with fungicides, you know, with herbicides? How well can that turf survive when its neighbors are those chemicals?
That's a great question. And just like us, again, I mean, I hate using these comparisons, but I think more people can relate to human health because it's usually you hear more about it. But just like when we take antibiotics, it's often what suggested that you eat yogurt soon thereafter type of thing to try to come back behind that disturbance with a probiotic to try to get your system kind of back in line. Because you're right, these inputs, even fertilizing, even watering, going through a drought, changing pH, these things all alter the environment just slightly enough that it can develop swings in the microbial balance, if you will, that's always in flux. You know, it's always coming and going, so to speak, in a sense of the dynamics of the population and the percentages of the fungi and the bacteria and the protozoa and the nematodes. These things are always in some kind of balance, but always changing that balance. And whatever we do out there can impact that. I can say, though, that most of the things we use are friendly enough where that balance is it's offset for a very short period of time. But still, to your point, we're still messing with that balance.
In the past couple of decades, have you been able to reduce the chemical input?
That's a tough question to answer because some of the products we use now are so environmentally friendly that they're short-lived and they're very narrow targeted. Those old guys we referred to earlier that are now, you know, no longer in use, they were very broad spectrum and very persistent. So if you count the number of sprays back then, like, you know, they had Chlordane that would take care of ants, right, in the old days. Well, you did that once or twice a year. You didn't have to worry about ants anymore. Okay, so
what about collateral damage?
Well, that's why it's gone. It's too persistent. So the EPA is only basically happy with things that are far less persistent and more narrow in its target of effects. So that being said, sometimes you got to apply more of those products more often to get that longevity compared to in the past. But in the big picture, yes, to answer your question, we are doing more with fewer inputs as far as a chemical goes, because we're relying more and more on this organic approach to help us buy some time, offer a higher degree of plant health, and just put the fires out with the chemicals when the fires need to be put out, if that makes sense.
Do you do more spot treatment than you used to do?
Yes, and that's a big cost-saving practice. You know, scouting IPM is really the cornerstone here.
And, of course, we're talking about integrated pest management for folks who don't know what that is. And that is a practice that has been taught and preached now for decades.
Right. And it's, you know, the scouting's a big part of it. So we're here every day, 7 days a week. So we're here looking at this ground and the soil and how it's behaving. And so a cornerstone of IPM, in my view, is to be on top of things before they get too bad and make the corrections that might be needed, whether it's a deficiency of nutrients or moisture, and make your correction as soon thereafter to ensure the plant health at a higher degree. And I think it's well recognized that healthier plants can withstand stresses better, whether it's from a pest, a disease, or environmental stress. So that's the backbone of IPM, is to try to have that broad range of inputs and practices that's available to you to ensure plant health and assessing that plant health daily.
One of the tenets of IPM, as I explain when I talk to groups, is, and this is not all of it, but it's part of it. There are various ways you can explain IPM, and one of the ways I try to explain it is to tell people that you start with the least toxic method first, and then work your way to the most toxic. Do you do that here too?
Yes, and that's a good way to put it. And you're right, IPM, even though it's been around for a long time, I think it's pretty well understood, I guess, to people, especially in the field. But you're right, it kind of has several meanings. In fact, I think it's evolved to integrated pest management, like you mentioned, to integrated plant management or plant health.
Yeah, some people say plant health.
Right. And integrated plant management is in the sense of the overall plant, because it's not just what we do out in the field that counts. It's how these products are stored, you know, and how they're mixed. So those are important aspects of ensuring an overall healthy facility and a benefit for the community is not just what's being applied, but even how it's being delivered, you know, and the packaging that it's in and things of that nature. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a ripple effect when you talk about trying to secure environmental health. It's not just what you're putting out there. It's what how it's being stored and et cetera.
That's Dan Donnelly, superintendent at North Shore Country Club in Chicago. And I think people might be surprised to hear that a golf course superintendent is talking biology and plant health and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of folks would think basically, they throw down fertilizer and they mow. That's all they do.
Well, grass can be pretty forgiving. You know, it's if you talk to an ecologist, you know, grasses are pretty early in the succession, and therefore they're forgiving in the sense that they'll colonize and grow in the crack of a sidewalk, right? So you look at that and you go, well, how tough can it be to grow a lawn, right? Yeah. When it's growing in the crack of a sidewalk or asphalt. But that kind of demonstrates how grasses are kind of a pioneering plant. They're early in the succession as it matures to eventually a climax forest in our area. But that being said, when you're managing a monoculture of any type, it tends to be challenging because that right away kind of is in conflict with how nature tends to behave, right? They want nature kind of reacts or, I should say, relies on diversity. And
that's a really excellent point right there, is that when you're growing a lawn, you have what is called a monoculture, meaning that there's usually, that's the species you're growing in. And in the forest, you're going to find a lot of different species, a lot of plant species. Now, of course, in a lawn mix, there are various kinds of grasses. You can have Kentucky Blue, and you can have fescue, and you can have rye in there. And that actually helps the plant health, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a great point, Mike. I mean, that's one of the things you try to do is develop healthy mixes when it comes to lawn, so you have that diversity. And, you know, part of that mix should help then the overall stand and withstand, you know, partial shade versus full sun and different soil types. The greater the diversity, the better the chance of the stand of turf persisting.
All right, what we're going to do here is I'm going to take a short break, and when I come back, Dan and I are standing right next to this amazing bin that's got, some compost in it and cabbage leaves, and I can see some tomatoes in there, and I can see lots of worms. And we're going to talk to him about how we put that into, you put that into the soil to help grow, to help the biome, as you talked about, to help the biology in the soil. And we'll get to that right after this on the Mike Novak Show.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687, for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Every time I open up an issue of Chicagoland Gardening magazine, I know I'm going to learn something. And if you've ever read my column on the inside back page of said magazine, you'd understand what a compliment that is, because I don't learn anything easily. You might pick up some knowledge in one of the excellent feature articles or one of the regular departments like Ask the Garden Pros, or the regional reports, or What to Do in the Garden, or you might even be inspired by one of the luscious photos. Not only that, but Chicagoland Gardening Magazine is just one of 21 different publications of state-by-state gardening. Wherever you live in the Midwest or the South, State-by-State Gardening has a magazine for you. They feature articles by some of the leading gardening experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners,
and even me. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Back on the Mike Novak Show at North Shore Country Club. Yeah, Country Club. With Dan Donnelly, the superintendent. We're standing next to his compost pile. Yes, folks, he has a compost pile right here on the golf course. Tell me about what's in here and what do you do with it?
Well, this is our vermicompost bins. We have several of them here. They look like large coffins. They're 4 by 8 feet by 4 feet tall.
I'm glad you brought up that vermicompost because it's a difference. It's, if you had a compost pile that was not in a bin,
right?
Do you have any of those?
Yes, but more or less static pile, you know, not really windrowed and done at a high level. But this material here, the vermicompost, this is how we manage our kitchen scraps up at the clubhouse. So all our worms are vegetarians, so no meat, no cheese, right? And so no high protein materials because that will spoil and rot. And so all the kitchen scraps we collect every day and bring them down here and feed our red wigglers. And each little red wiggler, they're small in size individually, but they can eat their weight in a day. So if I've got 50 to 100 pounds of worms in here, which I think I easily do.
Wow.
Yeah, I can top dress with 50 pounds of old lettuce and carrot tops and, you know, everything that's all that normally would go in the waste stream. And the worms here then digest it, and as it's going through their gut, the nutrients are passed along and parts of its flora and fauna. So the biology is very enhanced, and basically it's worm poop, if you will, that a lot of the old timers coined as black gold.
And average gardeners know about this. A lot of gardeners have compost piles. They have vermicompost bins. What do you do with this when it reaches a finished product?
Well, we do two things. One is we amend our sand with it as an organic amendment.
And that's important because there's lots of sand in or on a golf course.
Right. So, right. For, like you said, the greens are high percent sand. It's 90% sand. And that's so they drain extremely well. So they're playable regardless of the weather patterns. And they don't compact. As you know, there's a lot of foot traffic concentrated on greens, 6,000 square foot average size green. With 200 people, you know, stamping on it, it has to be a sandy type mix. Otherwise, there'd be an issue. So the next thing is how, what can you amend that high sand content? Because as you know, being that sand does drain well, it doesn't hold nutrients well. Its biology isn't that great. It doesn't hold nutrients or water, as I mentioned. So vermicompost is an awesome amendment to it at the right percentage.
So how do you apply this?
Well, we either apply it dry as part of the sand.
Do you sift what you have here? Because
yes.
This is a mix of everything. It's still got decomposed vegetable parts here, but there's also beautiful soil mixed in, and we just touched it a second ago. And folks, if you've got really good compost, then that just smells like heaven. This is wonderful. I know. I'm such a geek.
Well, that's a good observation, Mike, but these are what they call pass-through bins. So as you dig deeper in, you see most of this stuff has been, you know, decomposed. There might be a pit in there or something in there from like an avocado or something that hasn't been broken down. But what we do is we take the green fresh material and we just set it on top and top dress it. And then
do you sift it?
Yeah, then we just sift it and screen it out. And then the other way we apply it is through a extract or a tea. You know, you've heard a lot about compost teas and whatnot. So we've made a couple different types of equipment that we put it into like a slurry, a suspension, and then we spray it on. But, you know, what we like about that is we are doing it here on site, so it's very fresh. And we're really trying to focus on the fungal community, component of it. they're all important, all the organisms, whether it's protozoa, bacteria, whatever. But the fungal community for us, we feel like, is the weakest link. So if we want to favor one thing out of that community, one group of organisms, it's the fungal biomass. And as you know, yeasts and molds are okay in water, like, you know, wines and beers and stuff. But the true fungal community is not. So we put it in solution for a very short period of time and apply it within only a few days, so we ensure that we're delivering the whole community, especially the fungal component.
And I think folks need to understand that when you apply this to a green, and I think it's a common mistake people make about compost, while there are nutrients in there, it's not a fertilizer. It's really more about applying biology, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an awesome point, because you're not going to witness a major green up out there when you apply these things. And sometimes people feel as though there's nothing happening. And until you get a stress of some kind, whether it's from a pest or a disease or drought stress, you may not see the value of this biology. I kind of look at plant health as a stool of four legs. Plant genetics, huge, big part of it, right? Can't ignore genetics. It's like human health. There's so much being, you know, known and discovered about what happened in your lineage, you know, and the importance of what may happen with you in health. So you got plant genetics, and you have the chemical component, the physical component, and the biological component. So those are the four legs of the stool. You can have that stool stand on any three of those legs, perhaps, but it's most stable with all four of those legs beating at a high rate or a high level in its most optimized form, and that's part of the biology.
Well, you're kind of a mad scientist out here, as I've known for several years. So let's look at some of what you're working on here, some of the experiments with turf and their roots and the soil that the plants live in.
Wonderful. Let's go. Might be a little over the top, but we'll give it a try.
So we walked into the laboratory. You know, those almost look like tomato plants there.
They are tomato plants.
They're growing in your turf there,
yes,
Dan.
Yes, I know. Well, this is my plot of what I'm nicknamed my biocharged turf. And that's kind of got a dual meaning, the biocharge, because this medium here, we're standing inside an enclosed but yet open air.
And you've actually, we're facility. Outdoors, and you've, are those grow lights?
Yes, we got two artificial.
Outdoor grow lights. I've never seen this before.
Well, we're under roof, right? So yeah. we're avoiding rain on this ground. We're on a concrete floor, so no organisms can come in here. So I'm not going to say this is sterile, but basically what I'm trying to do is avoid any potential pathogens to colonize in this ground here. So what the soil is, we just talked and saw the vermicompost bins. So we take that material and we move it out here, and I amend it with biochar. So the biochar.
All right, now you got to explain what biochar is.
Well, biochar is a fascinating material. It's, for lack of better words, a type of charcoal. But biochar is a lot like compost, in my opinion, where there's good biochars, not so good biochars, and perhaps even bad biochars.
And it's been used for millennia.
Yeah, where's the area in South America that they talk about terracotta? Yeah. That they claim. In fact, if you talk to a biochar guy, they'll make a claim that I kind of believe, that the biggest deposit of the longest lasting benefit of our old prairies that made our corn belt was the char from the frequent burns that would occur over the decades and, you know, hundreds and thousands of years that these prairies were growing, and you'd get a lightning storm or whatever, and they would burn.
It's, well, from what I understand, Native Americans also set fires in the prairies.
Right. So you can argue that the burn itself has got some short-term benefits. You know, it opens up the ground. It's got some weed control components to it, right? But the long-lasting benefit is the char, not the ash, but the char that was left behind that made our black organic soils. So biochar is a byproduct. You know, there's some people making it specifically, but I'm using a byproduct of the bioenergy industry. So, you know, they're making these biofuels, and whether it's out of switchgrass or trees, and usually it's a byproduct stream of some organic nature, right? And they heat it up with little or no oxygen. And when it does that, it burns off all the organic or all the volatile compounds in there, the oils and the tars and stuff. And what it leaves behind is this skeleton, crystallized skeleton of carbon that is very persistent in the soils. It lasts a long, long time. And the surface area of that is phenomenal. It's huge. And the beauty of biochar is they have what they call the high CEC, cation exchange capacity, which is how they term something's ability to hang on to, we'll say, plant nutrients, right? The cations and anions, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassiums, and things of that nature.
And he's not geeking out, folks. This is really important stuff. And if you don't know what CEC is, Google it.
Yeah, it's a little technical, but soil tests and whatnot will have that as part of their analysis. But long story short, this biochar also has a tremendous amount of surface area, they call it. So picture a sponge, if you will. And biochar looks a lot like that sponge with all those little tunnels and nicks and crannies and cavities. And if you break that apart, the amount of surface area in that is phenomenal. So that surface area is a wonderful niche or habitat for biology. And so that I'm using that to help ensure a higher degree of transplant. We talk about transplanting often flowers, vegetables, and trees and shrubs. But now we're talking about transplanting the microbes, the microbiome. So what we have growing here now is my turf on top of this already nutrient-rich, very rich in biology with no bad guys yet, you know, no pathogens yet. Had a chance to get established here. And so the thing that's fascinating about this is we all recognize the importance of networking, right? Surround yourself with good people and develop relationships. Well, the plant community's known that from day one. And so 10 to 30% of the energy that it makes through photosynthesis, the sugars, are released through the roots as what they call exudates. And these exudates, its purpose is to develop these relationships
right.
with the microbes.
If you know anything about the soil food web, and there's another thing I would advise people to Google, the exudates actually attract the fungi and the bacteria.
Absolutely. And so that's what we're doing here. That's the area around the root, they call it the rhizosphere. The rhizosphere is everything in, on, and around the root of a plant. And that area, that zone, is 10 times more rich in biology than the soil outside that zone. And probably just as important or more so is that biology is very specific to that plant. Now, unfortunately, there's a few bad characters out there that also recognize these exudates as a food source and can become pathogenic, right? So there's a few of those guys. So the whole meaning behind what we're doing here is that it's some of this boils down to a numbers game. So if we can overwhelm the system with all these good guys, right, then it makes the bad guys a little more challenging for them to become problematic.
So this experiment here, how do you apply it to what you're doing on the golf course?
So you'll see here the cavities.
Are these new trial areas here?
These are the new trial areas, and you'll see the flags with numbers. So every number you'll see represented three times throughout here.
So they look like raised beds, except they're sunken into the ground. How deep are we looking at right here?
Well, that's a foot, so they're going to be backfilled with a foot of sand.
And there's already pea gravel in the
right.
base, and how far does the pea gravel go
that's
down?
That's 4 inches deep.
Okay.
With drain tile underneath. That's where that trench is there.
Ah, okay.
And you can see the slight different color variations of the mixes themselves. Some are a little darker. It depends on what the percent is of biochar or vermicompost that we have. We've been using also a commercially available vermicompost from Terravesco on California. They have a very consistent way of producing their material. That's another challenge. As long as we're talking about organics and compost and biochar, you have to accept some degree of variation, but it can't vary enough where our results will be different each time we use them. And with compost, you know, it depends on the temperature, the moisture, how much it's turned, the aeration. There's a whole science and art in creating high quality compost. And the feedstock's usually important too. You know, how steady of a stream is there of a consistent type of feedstock? So all these things feed into potential variabilities. So the things that I'm doing are going to be more varied than a system that's got very consistent feedstock, consistent conditions. Out in California, this company has done that. So I want to make sure whatever we do here for testing, I can duplicate next year. So I'm using this Terravesco type vermicompost.
I notice you have apple trees.
Mm-hmm.
How many apple trees do you have on the ground?
Oh boy, we have about 40, and then some pear trees. We have an organic garden that we started a couple years ago to grow produce for the kitchen, to tomatoes and peppers. And so, you know, when you got this kind of land, it's wonderful. We have 170 acres. You need about 150 for the golf course, so that leaves several other acres. So you also see the naturalized area.
Yes.
We talked about diversity. So we try to encourage biodiversity out here in the out-of-play areas, whether it's growing a garden, whether it's growing an apple orchard, or in these natural, I call them naturalized areas. There's a lot of prairie plants in there, but I'm not a purist, so there's some ornamentals in there too, like Shasta daisies, and you know, butterflies love them, bees love them. So not being a purist, I welcome plants like that, but still most of them are the native prairie plants because they're much lower maintenance.
Folks, that's a golf course superintendent, and he's a good one. He knows his stuff. That's Dan Dinelli. I'm Mike Novak, and this is The Mike Novak Show.
You can find more information about The Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.